All right. It's a pleasure to be here again. So, ADS-CFT is a duality which relates a bulk quantum gravity theory with n asymptotically ADS regions with n copies of some particular CFT. In the best known examples, the bulk quantum gravity theory is a string theory, and in the most famous example, the CFT is n equals 4 super Yang Mills, but what I'm going to say doesn't depend on the details of the particular theory very much. I want to ask, what if this duality is incomplete? In the sense that the information in the CFT only maps to some of the information in the bulk. So everything in the CFT is in the bulk, but not everything in the bulk is in the CFT. In that case, the notation that Don and I are using is that there are multiple super selection sectors which contain the same bulk information, but different, sorry, the set different bulk information, but the same boundary info. So different bulk states mapping to the same boundary. So let me make some notation here. Let's define bulk one as the most general set of states in your quantum gravity theory that has one asymptotically ADS region. And I'm going to say that that is dual to the CFT times some space of some other factor in your Hilbert space or space of sectors, which I'll call S1. And this is if there's one asymptotically ADS region. So that's the conformal boundary there. This is a picture of space at one time. Or for bulk two, that will be dual to CFT times whatever is the relevant space of super selection sectors when there are two CFTs. And most generally, bulk N will be dual to the CFT of the N times SN. So far, this is just notation. The substantive thing I'm going to be arguing for is that when I say there exist super selection sectors, plural, I mean that these S factors have two or more states. Does that make sense? Everyone got that? Okay. So it's important to realize.
When you say states,
yeah.
When you say SN has at least two states, are we to think of it as Hilbert space? You mean its dimension is at least two, or is it more general kind of idea?
Well, the you can for the most part, I'm thinking of them as being Hilbert spaces. I feel sure that you could generalize that and discuss it in a more algebraic way. I don't think. I think, though, that all of these things ought to be type one, which means you can get away with thinking of them as a Hilbert space. But if you don't agree, then maybe they would be different.
I make a suggestion, you just say yes.
Yes.
Because the importance of your results will depend on how precise they are. And if you have results in the context in which you have originally duality between Hilbert spaces, just discuss that phase.
Well, okay. Let's yes might be a good answer, but I have some more preliminary comments here. The I want to point out that this hypothesis does not contradict the unitarity of the CFT evolution, because as emphasized in these earlier papers by Don, if you have so Don has this clever argument based on the Hamiltonian being on the boundary, which says that any you would expect in a gravitational theory there would be this boundary unitarity property in an asymptotically ADS space. And of course it's well known that the CFT is unitary. Any information at one moment of time on the CFT is also present at a later moment of time. The important thing to realize is that that in no way rules out that there might be information that is never on the boundary. So this just says any information at one time is there for all time, but there are these super selection degrees of freedom would have to be not present at the boundary at any time. So now two comments about what kind of degrees of freedom these are, about the super selection information. One of them is that because the boundary stress tensor is an operator in the CFT, maybe that looks too redundant. So, because the stress energy tensor is a CFT operator, it follows that Sn, the superselection information, carries no energy or momentum. Because, of course, in the gravitational theory, the energy and momentum are defined at the boundary. So this is energy momentum free, or another way to put it is it's invariant under each ADS group. And the second point is that all such information must be hidden behind horizons. It must be hidden behind a past or a future horizon. And the argument for this is that if we draw a Penrose diagram here, if this is the future horizon and this is the past horizon, if you imagine operator which is localized outside of the past and the future horizon, then you could imagine acting with CFT observables in order to create a observer who falls in to the bulk, measures whatever local field you have, and then goes back out to the boundary and reports back. Things like this, in principle, ought to change the dynamics of the CFT. But by definition here, the CFT is just a closed system that obeys the rules of the CFT. So,
and you're going to assume that there's a horizon, this scenario happens if and only if there's a horizon present for all possible times?
This is the global horizon of the whole space-time.
So what I'm worried about is if we started out in something like the bulk where there's no original horizon present, then I would have thought I couldn't run into this scenario. But you're assuming there's, there's a horizon back to past infinity, yes?
So this does tend to come up. So you can also consider black holes that form from collapse. I'm not arguing. So let me just complete my statement here. What this implies is that anything constructed out of observables outside of the horizon lies in the CFT, and that therefore any superselection information must be behind the past or the future horizon. What I am not arguing is the converse, that anything behind the horizon is therefore superselection. So in the case where you have a black hole that forms from collapse, you could argue by determinism in the bulk that information here, even though it's behind the horizon, because it came from outside, this is not asymptotically ADS. But
your picture's clear.
Good enough. Okay. It's still not super selection information. Yes?
What about a situation where there's initially past time-like infinity on the past boundary? There are some local degrees of freedom which don't couple to gravity. That is, say there's a symmetry, a color symmetry, which commutes with gravity, and you want to know what color some degree of freedom is set to. And there's no, assume that it's not coupled to a long-range gauge field, it's not coupled to gravity, and simply stays for the entire infinity of time inside the bulb, deep inside the bulb, and the value of that color charge is never communicated to infinity. Is that in your superselection sector?
Because you could send in an observer to measure it, it cannot be.
Even if it's not coupled to gravity, not coupled to long range gauge field?
Well, even if it's not coupled to, okay, well, no, wait a minute.
By not coupled to gravity, I mean, the object can have mass, but what color it is a symmetry.
Oh, there's a global symmetry. Yeah. There are some arguments which may or may not be persuasive that maybe there cannot be such global charges in a quantum gravity theory.
Well, I can certainly make a classical gravity.
That's certainly true. But just to answer the question, I would say that because you could have sent in an observer to measure that color, it would therefore follow that it must be in the CFT.
What guarantees that I can send an observer in? Because send an observer in is code for there's an operator in the conformal field theory,
right,
that couples to a bulk operator that can measure this. But
I think that an operator actually creates some entity that falls in towards the bulk, but yeah.
Can we postpone the discussion to the end of the talk, maybe, before makes a statement?
Sure.
Looks like maybe there are going to be lots of discussion.
That's probably true.
So,
okay. So now I'm going to talk about some arguments for these super selection sectors, and I'm going to warn you they're not all original to me and Don. Some of them are in fact very old, but just to give a complete picture of what the various conceptual arguments are for this, I want to start with some old stuff. So I want to start with the case where there's one boundary. So a little more notation. Let bulk bar, which is in bulk one, be one particular ADS-CFT duality relating the CFT to some particular choice of superselection sector. So bulk bar is a subset of states in bulk one, which is by construction dual to the CFT. If there's just one super selection sector, it's the same as bulk one. But if there's more than one, we just pick one. Okay? One particular sector, which corresponds to with connected asymptotically ADS spacetimes. All right, now the first argument I'm going to make, so here's the CFT, and here's a space diagram. So it's dual set. First argument I'm going to make is so trivial that it almost is just obvious, but I think it's still worth saying. We can tensor this now with the closed universe. Now, we can make a closed FRW universe, which can store a potentially infinite amount of information. At least semi-classically, that seems to be true. Whereas in the CFT, there's a finite number of states below any given energy. So it seems obvious then. So most people believe that if you define quantum gravity in a closed universe, there should be more than one possible state. And in fact, semi-classically, there seems to be an infinite number. So most people, so that would suggest that given this, there's no way that information can be present in the CFT. And really, you should have objected earlier here when I wrote something that implied that 1 was the first natural number. That's totally heretical. 0 is the first natural number. I should have written this as my first line. And if I'd done that, I could just point out that probably almost everyone in the room already believes that there's super selection sectors in the first S0. In other words, that there are states of a closed universe. So that's a sort of almost trivial argument. I think it's worth making. But then you can modify this slightly by adding a little wormhole here that connects these two spacetimes. And at least in an intuitive hand-waving sense, you'd say if there's a tiny wormhole there connecting the two spacetimes, you wouldn't think it would change the picture by all that much. But in that case, we have, this is called the bag of gold spacetime. This is one of those old arguments. In that case, it seems like all of this extra information in the bag of gold must be information in S1 there. If we draw a Penrose diagram, if this is the CFT, then anytime we have one of these bags of gold, we always find that there's a region behind the past and future horizons that therefore might store information that can't be measured by an observer who drops in and returns to the boundary.
Singularity, and so therefore, strictly speaking, I don't know what's going on.
Well, yeah, normally you would have a past singularity there, and assuming the null energy condition or something. And so you cannot create such a thing from collapse, which makes perfect sense on this picture, because if you started with a super selection sector that was just vacuum ADS, and you just act on it in the CFT to make stuff that you throw in from the boundary, there's no way you can change the state you picked of S1. So that's in what you would expect.
You can't make such a thing as classical general relativity without violating the energy conditions. But why can't you make it in the quantum theory?
That's a very good question. So I have argued in one of my papers that I don't have much time to go into, but I've argued that the sorts of things you can prove in general relativity from the null energy condition. So a lot of people would say, well, you can violate that in quantum gravity. I've argued that at least if you take the generalized second law as a sort of baseline principle that you believe in, that the entropy always increases for causal horizons, then you can use that instead of the null energy condition to prove a long list of results that is the same sorts of things you get from the null energy condition in classical GR. So I strongly suspect that this sort of thing is impossible even in quantum gravity. And there's some other evidence for that in other people's work. I think Rob Myers has a paper where he showed you couldn't restart inflation, or at least he argued you couldn't restart inflation in an ADS universe. I think there's an instanton calculation which similarly gives zero probability for that. So I don't think one should assume that just because you are violating the null energy condition that you can do anything.
Back things up, but what is bulk one?
Bulk one, yeah.
What do you mean by that? I hear the words quantum gravity, and then I hear or I see pictures of classical space time. So could you just elucidate a little bit more what you're thinking of on that side?
Right. So I'm assuming that there is such a thing as quantum gravity, and that even if there's particular observables, the particular observables become quantum, and it's not entirely clear what the local degrees of freedom are. But I guess I'm assuming that one thing you can still do is count the number of asymptotically ADS regions that are in the space-time, even when it's highly quantum mechanical. Because things tend to go more classical as you move to the boundary.
Your examples are just going to be classical space times, but that's more just that they're easier to think about.
That's part of it. There's going to be something like a quantum example coming up, a space time that doesn't really have a clean, probably doesn't have a clean classical interpretation. So now I want to say something about why this makes sense from a fundamental quantum gravity.
Yeah. If I wrote down an ADS space time with one boundary, could you tell me if I'm just in the CFT or which super selection sector? Like you argued that an ADS with a bag of gold is somehow not in
same one.
Yeah, not
as vacuum.
So if I just if one starts writing down initial conditions, I don't know what randomly means, but lots of them. Can you tell which ones are in the same super selecting sector and which ones are?
That's a good question. I'm not sure the answer to that. I'm going to have some specific arguments that specific pairs of space time are different, but I think that is a good question to ask. So why would you expect a picture like this to be true? From a fundamental quantum gravity perspective, I'd say what we're really trying to do is we're really trying to construct gauge invariant observables. And I'd say there's at least two strategies for doing this. If you had a closed universe, what you'd want to do is you'd want to look for fully diffeomorphism invariant observables. And these have the property that they must be perennials, meaning they make no reference to any kind of background time. And similarly, they make no fundamental reference to any kind of space position. Everything needs to be constructed relationally. I probably don't need to drive in this point to this audience. But as a nice example of this that comes into string theory if you have a string, a closed string, just and you view the string world sheet as being a, like a 1 plus 1 dimensional quantum gravity theory, then people construct these vertex operators, which are integrals over the string world sheet of some scalar quantity. And because it's a scalar and you're integrating it over all space-time, at the end, this observable, which is something that tells you how strings merge in or out of this other string, they make no reference to, they're background free on this string. They make no reference to any kind of time or space position. A second strategy for constructing gauge invariant observables comes when you have a boundary, such as, for example, asymptotically ADS theories. So in an asymptotically ADS space-time, we have the option, we know that boundary diffeomorphisms aren't gauge. And that means we have the option to use the coordinates on the boundary to pick some particular local point on the boundary. And then we can construct a gauge invariant observable in the bulk by some sort of Wilson line type approach, where we're defining something in the bulk relationally with respect to some coordinates on the boundary. And these sorts of observables are really important to ADS-CFT. Essentially, what happens is this operator, as this point x approaches the boundary, the asymptotics of this are maybe the best well-understood part of the ADS-CFT dictionary that says what in the ADS corresponds to what in the CFT. So my big point is this. Just because the boundary opens up this additional strategy for constructing observables in the bulk, I don't see why this first strategy, the sort of thing you'd use in a closed universe, would necessarily fail in an asymptotically ADS universe. Just because you have these extra observables using the fact that the boundary diffeos aren't gauged doesn't mean you couldn't try to construct observables that are fully diffeomorphism invariant, including that they transform trivially under the ADS group. Now, you can worry about infrared divergences or something if we do an integral and it goes out to the boundary. So, I mean, to really turn this into a program, there's maybe you'd need to renormalize that with boundary observables or something. But just at the hand-waving level, I'd like to say it makes sense to me that there should be such observables.
Another comment is the real world is not ADS.
Exactly.
And it might, for example, have an initial boundary. You know, there might have been a beginning. And that also raises a whole, that also brings in the possibility of a whole new set of observables. In fact, in the case of the causal set cosmologies, you can argue that they're a complete set. I mean, there's some things that are defined by making use of the fact that there's a beginning.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, that connects to even people who are usually, a lot of string theorists who may not like what I'm saying here, a lot of them try to generalize ADS-CFT to what they call DS-CFT, which is essentially using a time-like boundary to construct observables. But then, if you had this bag of gold, if this is actually goes into a de Sitter universe, I would say, well, don't you expect there to be ADS observables and DS observables? And then they're essentially conceding my point. All right, so now I want to talk about an argument that uses two boundaries, and this is the main new argument. This is the main new argument of my paper with Don. So, we're going to continue to use this bulk bar notation. So remember, bulk bar is one particular dual to bulk one, specifically. And I'm going to assume that bulk bar is a complete theory, that if you just were stuck in bulk bar and you just had to make measurements in bulk bar, everything you would want to know about the space-time is encoded in some way in bulk bar. So now I'm going to use the fact that according to Maldacena, the ADS-Schwarzschild eternal black hole is dual to a special CFT state. So I'm going to call this the wormhole state with two asymptotic regions. And it's defined as a sum. It's a thermofield double. So it's a sum over energy eigenstates of the left CFT and of the right CFT. And if you restrict to the right or to the left, you get a canonical ensemble. But to be clear, this is by definition a state in CFT times CFT. Well, this is by definition a state in bulk two. So this is how we're using the duality here. So what I want to argue is that S2 must contain at least two states because I can construct another state in bulk two which corresponds to the same boundary state in the CFT times the CFT. And the way I'm going to do this is as follows. I'm going to use this duality between the CFT and bulk bar, and I'm going to define a thermofield double state by taking each of these CFTs and separately using the duality to bulk bar and construct this state in bulk two. So this is an entangled state between two bulk bars. So if I draw a picture of it, this state is a wormhole connecting the left and right CFTs. This state contains two disconnected spacetimes. Now, I don't want to stop here. I could just say, okay, well, this state is connected. This spacetime is connected. This spacetime is not connected, so they're different, so I just proved it. But I don't want to say that because somebody could argue maybe these two spacetimes are really secretly equivalent. Mark Van Ramsdonk has made this sort of argument that he says when there's entanglement between two spatial regions, it's sort of equivalent to there being a wormhole between these two regions. So I don't want to, just because connected versus disconnected is a good classical gravity observable, I don't want to necessarily assume that it's a good observable in full quantum gravity. So instead of just assuming these are different states from each other, I want to prove that they are operationally distinct by making a specific Gedanken experiment where you observe different things depending on which of these two spacetimes you're in. Okay? So the way we're going to do that.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
The basic thought here, the basic insight is in both cases you have the same CFT on the boundary. Each boundary always has the same CFT.
Yeah.
So somehow, how could it possibly know whether there's another boundary there or not?
So the point is all of the observables in bulk bar, by stipulation, a bulk bar is sort of a complete quantum theory that's dual to the CFT. So just mathematically, nothing can prevent me from taking the tensor product of two such theories in a way where they're independent, and then I get this theory where they don't talk to each other.
But in some sense, the missing information that this one CFT can't know is whether there's another CFT there, which is connected onto via wormhole or whatever.
Right, but note that at the end of the day, I'm trying to construct two states which are different, both of which have another CFT.
Yes,
So that, yes. So it's not just that you don't know whether on the second or bulk one line or the bulk two line, but also that the S2 has two states, yeah, at least. I assume infinity, but I'm just proving two right now. Okay, so here's the argument. Here's a Penrose diagram of this wormhole. Okay, with the left CFT and the right CFT. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to create Alice on this right-hand CFT, and I'm going to create a Bob on this. So these are intrepid explorers, both of whom are foolhardy enough to jump into a black hole, and we can arrange on this space-time, which is in which the semi-classical approximation holds, we can arrange it so that if we arrange the initial velocities and times, we can arrange it so Alice and Bob meet each other and fall in love and get married before they die into the singularity. Okay? So then my argument here is that in a complete theory of quantum gravity ought to give predictions to questions like, if Alice jumps into this black hole, what are the odds that she will meet a Bob? Let's phrase that carefully. Okay, so I wanted to say, first of all, we create Alice with an operator in the CFTR. So let this be a unitary operator in CFTR, which creates Alice when acting on the W2. So the, you might say a unitary operator is not a creation operator, but we can arrange it so it reliably creates a particular physical object when acting on a particular state. We can make it so Alice is at a frequency much higher than the thermal background. All right, and similarly, e to the ib is a unitary in CFTL, which creates Bob. So that's what we have here. And let P be a projection operator which asks this question. Does Alice meet A? Does this Alice meet A Bob behind the horizon? I guess behind the horizon is really redundant if there's no Bob outside the horizon. So notice how I phrased this. After I create this Alice, I want P to tell me whether Alice meets a Bob. So Alice is created at a particular time. Now, whether or not Alice meets this particular Bob that was created on the left CFT is not really an operational question. Alice can't know that. What she can know is whether she meets a physical system which resembles Bob. So she can't necessarily tell whether Bob came from there or somewhere else, but she can certainly tell whether she meets someone who looks like Bob. So that's the projection operator. And now the simple quantum mechanics argument. There's a simple quantum mechanics argument that says that the projection operator has two different values in these two states. So first of all, in W2, if we create both Alice and Bob, and then we ask whether Alice meets Bob, the answer is very close to 1. It may not be exactly Bob, it may not be exactly 1, because there may be a rare quantum fluctuation that destroys Bob, but it's close to 1. And this is because of the semi-classical approximation. So we know what we're talking about without having to actually quantize gravity. Then, if we don't create Bob, if we just create Alice, then clearly the probability drops to nearly 0. Again, there might be a quantum fluctuating Bob, but it's not terribly likely. So the so that both of these use the semi-classical approximation. This state, on the other hand, is a highly entangled state involving states of the one-sided black hole system. So this is actually the state which I told you, Rob, does not necessarily have a semi-classical description. So we cannot use the semi-classical approximation to tell us anything about this state once you cross the horizon. What we can use is the fact that bulk bar is by construction an independent, a theory that answers all the questions you might want to know if you just have one CFT. And therefore, it inherits the value, the interpretation of P in this state. It inherits it from the case where there's just one CFT. So what this tells us is that in this space-time, whether or not P is true depends only on this right CFT, which was not true for this wormhole, as we saw here. So what this tells us is that in this thermofield double state of the bulk, if we create both Alice and Bob, we get the same result as if we didn't create Bob at all, because P is, in this case, an operator entirely in the right-hand CFT. So this state here, is believed to exist and be semi-classical, and there's a lot of evidence that it makes sense and is dual to the CFT times CFT. This state must also exist because it's, if you believe that there's such a thing as ADS CFT for a one-sided, when there's just one CFT for a one-sided black hole, we can construct this just using the mathematical tensor product. But because in this case P differs, and in this P depends on whether we create Bob, and in this case it doesn't, if we want to include both of these seemingly consistent states in our bulk 2, which is defined as the broadest possible set of quantum space-times we can write down, we must conclude that they're two different states. But they're the same on the CFT times the CFT, and therefore the only remaining conclusion is that they differ in S2. So that is the main argument of my paper with Dunn. Are there any questions about that?
Third line of the board, P was going to be an operator that acts in the tensor product of both CFTs. But then at the end of the board, you were saying, no, it's an operator that acts in CFT1. So I didn't.
Right. So, So really, the ultimate statement is that P acts in CFT times CFT times S2 in such a way that if we pick one of the sectors in S2, it acts in just one of the CFTs. And if we pick another sector of S2, it acts in both. And so in the thermal field double state.
Yeah. What was the argument that said P is an operator in CFT1?
Right. So if we take this tensor product theory, then it's important. All Hilbert spaces of countable dimension are isomorphic to each other. So if we have a theory, it's not just specified by Hilbert space, it's specified by Hilbert space together with the set of all operators we might measure and what their interpretations are. So in the case, bulk bar is a particular theory that's dual to the CFT in which we have, via bulk one, a set of interpretations for all the operators. So there is an operator P, which is in bulk one. There's an operator P, which is in bulk one, that tells you if you just had that one CFT, does Alice meet a Bob? And I'm saying that you can take the tensor product of the entire complex of Hilbert space plus operators with itself, and that has an interpretation as this double space, entangled double space-time, where the answer to P, by that construction, must be inside just the one CFT.
I'm going to have to ask you later again. I mean, do you agree there are operators that live in both?
There's operators that live in both.
I'll ask you again later, sorry.
Yes. Any other questions on this?
Does bulk one have any semi-classical? Would you say it cannot have a semi-classical?
So bulk one is the space of all possible space-times that has one asymptotically
aerial
space.
Okay.
So some of them have
W2. If you put this W2 state or whatever.
W2 is specifically the wormhole state. Do you mean
okay,
the thermal field double state here?
If you put the state that belongs just to the one CFT.
Yeah.
Does that have any then within bulk one, does that have any semi-classical? Would you say it cannot have, or you don't know, or it does?
I think so, just the thermal state.
Yeah.
The thermal mixed state. I think it does not have a semi-classical interpretation, but it is a quantum superposition of states that do. So you can consider a state where you have a one-sided black hole and you form it from collapse of some particular shell of matter. And if you, that gives one particular state. And then if you time translate that state, then you can, you get one parameter family of such states. By superposing states, just this one state with its time translation, you can get pretty close to any state in the CFT you like. Because you can get the energy, you can pick off any energy eigenvalue. You can pick off any energy eigenvalue just by taking a coherent sum with a complex exponential. And then you can superpose the energy eigenstate however you like. Yeah.
I have a question maybe along the same line as well, which is, so you're saying, okay, you have this operator, which answers the question, does that meet the problem? And your assumption is that this operator acts only on one CFT. That's your assumption.
No, only for this Only in this situation, the assumption is that if we start with this space-time, that when P is sandwiched, the assumption is that when P is sandwiched in between the thermofield double state, that it is invariant under a unitary operation of the other side. Yes. Yes, it does not depend on the state, okay. but it can still reduce to a different operator of the CFT times CFT depending on which sector of S2 we're in. Okay.
So P is an operator that acts on both copies of the CFT.
In general. Yeah.
So now you're saying if I take P in this TFD state, it doesn't see the copy 2.
Right.
Where does that come from?
And that comes from the fact that there is a one-sided, if we take a one-sided black hole, so let's just take a one-sided black hole state and we create Alice and we ask whether in this one-sided black hole state Alice sees Bob, then we're assuming we have an answer to that question that's well-defined in the one CFT.
But what you just wrote doesn't make sense because P now is an operator that acts on the tensor product.
So this is a P of one. We're saying there's a P of one, a P that is defined on the one CFT state, which is the answer to the question, does this Alice meet a Bob? Yes, you can ask. Remember, this is a physical. This is an operational question. So, whether or not there's another CFT, there must be an answer to the question of what does Alice see if she jumps into the black hole.
You just told me that P is an operator that lives on the two copies, so you cannot. The nature of the projector cannot change. Here you have the same question, but you have a different operator.
Right, so these are two different P's defined as operators, but they answer the same operational question in these two separate cases, one where you have one CFT and the other where you have two CFTs.
I'm confused by, so I understand the first setting where you have P. In the second setting, where you have only one CFT, Could you be a bit more precise about what there's no notion of Bob then. So how can you even?
Bob is not defined as a particular physical object. You know, he's a man who's 6'2", who likes this such and such a sport team, and so on.
Can you define P1 then? So let's say here you have defined P, and then is there a way in which you can define P1? What is P1?
So P1 asks the question, suppose we have a particular state of a one-sided with one CFT, and we create this Alice as so on the boundary. The question is, does Alice meet a Bob? And so it's in that context, that question can be answered by a projection operator on a single CFT.
Sorry. Can you define the operator without referring to a state?
Well,
it's confusing.
So if
I have only one boundary, I don't have any notion of Bob because I don't have any notion of other boundaries. So I can't even, I'm not sure what you're. I'm confused about how you define P1 on CFT1. Where's your definition? If you have only one boundary state. I mean, Bob, I thought, was some object coming from boundary 2. So now you have only CFT1.
Right, some specific object whether or not he comes from the other boundary. All Alice can observe is this region of, the place where Alice meets Bob is this region of the space-time diagram. She can't really know Maybe Bob can tell her that he came from a CFT, but that's just some ultimately some information encoded into Bob's brain, and you could imagine some. Yeah.
Can you define P1 on CFT1? That is, can you define the notion of above on just on CFT1? It seems to me you can't.
But you think that it's not an operational question whether if Alice jumps into a one-sided black hole, she sees some particular object behind the horizon?
I have one CFT. The CFT describes black holes or not black holes. So an operator, you know, here you're defining the operator with respect to a particular state. But can you define this operator independently of the fact that there is a black hole or no black hole? The CFT contains all possible states.
I mean, right? Yeah. I mean, you might ask in the bulk. I mean, there's in some implicit idea that in this bulk car or whatever you call it,
yes,
that there's some operator that asks, "Is there a Bob here?"
Yeah.
So and what then is, by the duality, that's supposed to be some translation.
Yeah,
into and some I
mean, then in the
and,
bulk, the, yeah.
And then if there's only one boundary, it's translatable into an operator just in that one boundary.
But in the bulk bow, you cannot define
if you believe this,
yeah.
But I thought by definition, the bulk bow, there's no bulk.
No.
Because Bob comes is something.
But there might have been a Bob created on the other on the same boundary who came in.
Right, and
you
Bob comes
in.
So what is a Bob? Okay. What is a Bob from
so
the point of view of
CFT1? You could create a Bob here, and he could jump in earlier. Yeah.
Can you have a diagram where you have only one?
Bob is Alice's definition of her dream date.
So can you show the diagram where you have only one boundary and not two? And
yeah.
Then define Bob there. So you have only one boundary.
So here's Bob. Here's Alice. Maybe this Alice is going too fast here. But you... It's true. P is now true in this space-time.
So you define Bob by being anything that happens behind an horizon in a particular state in the CFT? Is that...
Right, so you could say Alice, being an object, traces out some approximate world line, and I ask whether a Bob object ever appears at any point along this world line. I'm true. I'm not phrasing this in terms of fundamental fields, of course, but.
What I don't understand is whether you're able to define P as an operator. It seems you're defining P as an operator that depends on the state. You know. I should say.
I should say it is a fundamental assumption of this approach, not proven but assumed, that any time I can make that statements about what an observer sees if she jumps across the horizon are given by quantum mechanical operators in the usual linear way. If you don't believe that assumption, the conclusion will not follow. It seems a very reasonable assumption to me. And when I thought about the alternatives of modifying quantum mechanics to make it so that this state and this state were really the same, in the end, that seemed to me crazier than this assertion that there's just this other factor in the Hilbert space. But it's just an assumption that for any operationalizable question about what some particular measuring apparatus sees behind the horizon, we can find a quantum operator. And yeah,
there's a mixing of some. I mean, you need this notion of horizon, which is a classical notion, mixed with quantum. So it's confusing, I guess, because you'd like to have a reasoning which doesn't rely on this notion of horizon.
Right. Well, so strictly speaking, P doesn't talk about horizons. I use the semi-classical approximation here. At this line, I don't need to assume.
But P1 does. That's my problem.
No,
P doesn't talk about horizons, but P1 does.
We could make it so P1 is also true if Alice and Bob meet outside the horizon. If just Alice ever meets a Bob anywhere, it's true. So that doesn't refer to horizons. Although
P is an operator in CFT times S2. You can only make P in that space. You can't make P in the space CFT times S2.
Yes.
So, but then you're assuming that P can be made. You're assuming that S2 is there to be able to make P. It seems somehow circular.
I don't think so. The point is that that in a particular in space times, which are constructed in this way, we know what the answer is to the physical question that is P. In space times that are constructed like this, with the wormhole, we know what is the answer physically to the question that is P. It turns out in these two space times that they are P ends up being a different operator in CFT times CFT, but that can be viewed consistently if you view it as an operator in CFT times CFT times S2.
But suppose you just had two quantum mechanics, you know, two Hilbert spaces, and you never thought about the semi-classical thing. I don't think you could do what you're doing here.
Well, I'm using this.
You're using some extra information, which is being put in by the semi-classics, which implies the S2.
Sure, that's an explicit assumption.
That this wormhole state exists, and that you can use the...
And it has a semi-classic.
Yes. So if you are prepared to deny that assumption, this argument won't go through. You could say maybe the wormhole doesn't exist. Maybe whether or not Alice sees Bob is just always an operator in her own CFT, and then you would evade this conclusion of superselection sectors. But
can you rerun the last equality why it's true? This is the key equality. So you have, you know, why exponential IA commute. So P, you told me P is an operator in the double CFT, and then you argue that exponential IA commute with P. Why does it commute with P?
Well, the statement is
nothing stops us from taking the mathematical tensor product of two theories with one asymptotically ADS region. If we believe that there is a theory that's well-defined in terms of one CFT, one asymptotically ADS spacetime, in which you can answer the question P, then that answer to P must be the same, even if we, in this tensor theory.
But can you use without words? Why you write this? Just what is the argument to? I think it's a basic question. The last equality. Why?
The sphere to here.
Yes, exactly.
That's well, P is.
So,
P commutes with B.
What?
I think it's that P commutes with B.
P commutes with B. Yes.
P lives in the right, and B lives on the left.
Sorry. So P, you're saying P, yes. You want to say that P commutes with B.
P commutes with B.
You mean?
When sandwiched in between.
Yeah, you want, you want to say that, but okay. Why?
Because TFD is in a sector of the theory which is constructed in such a way that P just is an operator in the right-hand side.
No, you just told me, okay, that was my initial question. You just told me that P, okay, so can we rerun? Initially, I asked you for the question. You told me P is an operator that acts on both CFTs.
In general, yes, but I said there's one particular sector you can construct for which it's only in the right.
I don't know.
And that's precisely what leads to this conclusion.
How do you know that? I mean,
because
the operators define only once.
All right, so let me put it this way. Suppose you have the CFT, and you have some particular operator in the CFT that has some interpretation. I don't care. Just tell me, you know, the value of this field at this point is such and such. And suppose I just take the mathematical tensor product of that CFT with some completely different system, say the quantum mechanics of a harmonic oscillator. What do we mean when we take that tensor product? We mean we take the Hilbert tensor product of the Hilbert spaces, and for any operator that has a particular interpretation in the CFT, we just make it the same operator of that CFT. So it inherits the...
P is an operator that acts on H times H, H1 times H2, right? That was your initial description.
Can I ask maybe a question slightly, I mean, getting away from this exact question? You had more to say or not? Because you said you wanted to
I have more I could say, but I don't have
you
more.
Know, necessarily,
you
don't necessarily
have more arguments.
Just,
let him give
I'd rather get this argument straight with everybody than say any more.
Okay, but I'd like to ask a little bit about...
But you have a specific question.
Yeah, I'd like to ask a little bit about what you conclusion you draw from this, because it seemed to me that you were saying something like, if there was just one asymptotic region, I mean, your counterexample is based on this eternal black hole.
Yeah.
But you want to say, if you were willing to say that there are not eternal black holes and that they're all formed dynamically, would your conclusion switch around to the other direction? Would you then say that there are no superselection sectors?
I would say black holes that can be formed from collapse presumably lie in one particular superselection sector. But I don't see any reason why one should eliminate a priori the other ones. There's just a question of what's sort of the most general notion of a quantum gravitational space-time which we can construct, which is consistent. So I mean, classical GR, we can write down whatever solution we want. It could be an eternal black hole, it can be a bag of gold, it can be whatever, and
well,
we just evolve it.
It might have closed time-like curves, and you might
sure,
say
there's some restrictions. But you use the question is what you just want sort of as big of a consistent space of possibilities as you can. And then maybe experiment tells you that one particular kind of space-time is the right one to use. But
but if we were willing to limit ourselves to just one asymptotic region, then you're still endorsing this.
It might be
the full ADS,
ADF. It might be in the end that only one of these superselection sectors is physically relevant, though in a sense none of them are because the real universe isn't asymptotically ADF. But if we pretended it were, it might be that one particular one of these is just the right one and you fix it from the beginning. But if we're listing the space of possible space-times before we know that, we want to include as big of a space as possible. Yeah.
This is a question in the same direction. Do you have a more general argument that if there is a space-time, like for example a wormhole that has more than one asymptotic region, more than one asymptotic ADS region, then living near the boundary of one, you can't measure any operator created on the other?
Living near the boundary of...
In other words, is it possible to do an experiment near one asymptotic boundary that can measure the value of an observable and another asymptotic boundary?
If you want to be able to measure, if you're in one of these wormhole space-times and you want to be able to measure something in the other CFT, say, you need to be willing to jump across the horizon. So you can't therefore be near the boundary because the horizon will be inside the ball.
So is there some kind of principle that you can't know whether, without jumping across the horizon, you can't know whether there is another asymptotic region?
Well, you can't know which superselection sector you're
in. Yeah, yeah. Right, you can't know anything besides your own CFT. Yeah.
So what is the now? Supposing somebody's reaction to your argument is, I'm interested in the quantum theory of gravity with one asymptotic region. And I have this amazing result, which is the ADS-CFT correspondence in that case.
Well, even with one asymptotic region, I've argued that there's a space of super selection sectors, S1, with the one boundary argument. So, but you mean, might they say, I'm only interested in one asymptotic region, and I'm not interested in anything that happens behind the horizon. Is that what this person would say? If they say that, then I would say, well, if you happen to be falling into the black hole, you probably would care whether or not there's a behind the horizon afterlife or not.
Did you give us an argument that S1 also has to be?
Yeah,
that's
well, the bag of gold is an argument.
Oh, that's
but ultimately, I sort of assume by induction that if there's multiple super selection sectors for one N, it's probably true for all the others.
But I thought you argued that, which I disagree with you about, but you said that your view is that you can't create the bag of gold through any process if it doesn't already exist.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you don't know whether or not there's a bag of gold, that information is in the super selection section.
Saying that you don't know whether there's a bag of gold means that you don't buy basically the stronghold rabbit principle or the strong rabbit thing.
Yes, and that is what I'm arguing against. So, yeah.
Okay, so we sort of already drifted into the discussion, so maybe we should just thank our speaker. And thanks to Mercer, we have cookies to continue the discussion if there are further questions.
So I think I would regard a conservative position as being that there are, strictly speaking, aren't really such things as strictly eternal black holes. That is, there's going to be some probability of it to fluctuate into some large gas, some thermal gas, because I could go the other way. And as long as some things are fundamentally reversible, then there should be some wrong. It might be advantage, it might be incredibly small, but it should be non-zero. There should be some probability for you to take the black hole and to transform it spontaneously into a bunch of a gas.
I would think that what you probably have there is something like a gas times a baby universe, and that when the black hole reforms, let me back up into this from another direction. If there's a recurrence time in the CFT, so if we go through the recurrence time, we come back to where we were before, and any super selection information remains the same because it doesn't change with time at all. So if you start with a wormhole, so suppose we start with this wormhole, and then as a result of the fluctuations, it becomes just two big bags of gas, and then the two black holes form again. After we finish going to the recurrence time, I think the wormhole needs to have reformed.
Well, I mean, I think you're asking, well, I'm not sure if I agree with it, but let's ask the simpler. So if there's just one boundary, let's make it simpler for ourselves for a second.
Yeah.
Would you agree that there really shouldn't be such a, that at some point the black hole, if I wait long enough, it'll fluctuate into something that's not a black hole?
I agree.
Okay. So therefore, if there would be super selection sectors, they're never going to be truly hidden. If I wait long enough, I'll see them. Yes?
Now you're assuming that you can see them once the black hole is gone.
Well, you started out with that assumption, right? I mean, that was your, what, assumption
two? My two says specifically you can't see them. All of the information must be hidden behind a past or future.
Okay, but the picture above that says if it's outside the horizon, which if the black hole disappears, there will be no one.
I think if the black hole disappears, there must be something like a baby universe left over containing the super selection information.
What?
It's the only way I can see it make the story consistent. I agree this may be an Achilles heel of the viewpoint, but I'm just trying to make it consistent for you. If your argument was that once the black hole evaporates entirely, even by its fluctuation, now everything is outside the horizon, but you cannot measure the super selection information. So if I agreed with you that that meant all of the information was available in this gas, I would have to conclude there are no super selection sectors. And because I want to maintain there are... Well, no, I agree that that is a potential problem with the position, but I still think this makes the best sense, because if you really thought that the information behind the horizon just disappeared when there was no black hole and never came back, then I think you'd run into some problems.
Well, I think everyone would agree with that, but I don't follow the connection to the previous line. Most of us would say that would mean you have a non-unitary CFT and, yeah, you have information loss, all that standard argument.
I said, what would you like to say? What is the completion of your story?
I think that there aren't really such things as eternal black holes. That's only a semi-classical approximation. And if I wait long enough, it'll break down. And so I think I'd want to say, well, if there's a way to make pull off the super selection, sorry, I don't know how to see it.
Why don't we just make a small black hole that's going to Hawking evaporate, and then it's not just by a fluctuation, it's almost certain to disappear.
Well, but those ones, I think Aaron would agree, and he can correct me, would be, that won't be that he needs to have, he needs to somehow sequester this information away.
Right, so yes, so if it formed from collapse, the...
Or if one just appeared, I could paragrade them and then let it evaporate or something.
Right.
I could do something like that.
Right, I mean, I could start to make even more speculative answers. Like, say, once it forms into the gas, you could imagine that each of the particles still has these sort of like quantum mechanical wormholes connecting it to other things. You know, so it keeps the connection information. But it is a serious problem because you could say if you start with this eternal black hole, you really expect it to eventually Hawking radiate away. So that would give you something like a Penrose diagram like this.
Well, I mean, I would say in the quantum gravity theory, those singularities have to be resolved. So something else.
I don't agree that they have to be resolved, but...
Okay, but I guess the other...
I mean, you could say, so temporarily there's no black hole, and then there's a black hole again. And so the question is, what do we want to draw then?
I'm not following you.
So I
don't, I don't know if this... I don't understand how that picture makes sense, but...
Well, I mean, you could say, this is an eternal black hole
okay. At
this moment of time. Eventually it radiates away and is gone. And we have a bunch of gas.
Uh-huh.
But then at the recurrence time, I would say we need the exact same picture again. So if this is the full recurrence time.
I mean, but a recurrence time isn't a statement that everything gets back into exactly. It's a statistical statement. It's not everyone is reset, you know, it's not some time loop.
If you can get arbitrarily close. So I can pick, if that time is long enough, I can get arbitrarily close back to where you were.
It's a statement that the wave function of the state
right.
vector gets arbitrarily.
So if the two,
sure.
if
I mean,
the tube size are,
yeah.
if the tube size are epsilon away from each other, that's good enough, right?
Well, I guess I wasn't sure what point we're making. I mean, and the other thing, I don't want to keep you forever, was on your bag of gold thing. Isn't the conservative statement to be? Clearly, those are states which are just not allowed. I mean, I think most of us would say there are some states which are clearly not allowed, i.e. negative mass Schwarzschild with some surrounding stuff.
I think you and I mean very different things by conservative. If you said totally reject the semi-classical approximation as being totally highly misleading and when it says that this is a consistent space-time, I would regard that as a very radical statement.
No, but you know, your picture, you told me earlier, that these things always have singularities in the beginning. So you put in a singularity to create those. So I don't know what basis you have for saying those are valid states. Do you have?
Well, there's a moment of time.
You mean like a Friedman universe is not a valid state?
There's a cross.
Well, I don't know how to make that.
Radiation-filled Friedman universe.
You're saying that the singularity ever forms, we toss out the state even before it was singular? That's not how people normally do things.
If you have a singularity, you don't know what's going on. I hope you would agree with that statement.
I don't know what's going on at the singularity.
Well, at the singularity or any place where signals from the singularity can propagate to the future.
We might be living in such a space time.
Well, I would say
the naive, you know, evidence is that we are.
You have a theory that is, right? The theories that we have break down somewhere.
Well, that's the same statement in a different form.
But that doesn't, that's not the same thing.
That kind of space time. Which may lack a theoretical understanding near the singularity, it certainly ought to be a valid solution of quantum gravity, because that's the kind of space-time that we appear to be living in.
No, I don't. I think that's. I mean, you cannot generalize from the statement that because we as GR would predict a Big Bang singularity, that therefore in the future presence of any singularity, it's all okay.
No, I didn't say that. I'm just saying certain singularities of the sort that we actually have in our space-time.
I'm not sure I can classify them, but okay.
Should be acceptable.
What rules would you propose?
There's a slice here.
I'd say we're in a zone of ignorance.
There's a slice here.
Sure.
There's a slice.
We can't do cosmology. I don't understand exactly what you're saying.
So there's a slice here where things are non-singular. If I just specify this slice as my initial condition, I can evolve either forwards or backwards in time, and eventually I reach a region that's singular. Now, it's true that if I started with this initial singularity, mm-hmm. I don't know what comes out of it, but I'm starting at
well,
this
no,
slice.
Well, no, but on your slice, you can get signals from there, so.
Well, but that's a time. I don't see why I should treat initial singularities as different from final singular. I could also say a signal could go to the final singularity. Would you say that is an equal?
Yeah, I mean, you made a time symmetric, so there's no distinction there. I'll agree to that. But, I mean, you could write down all sorts of states, and no, I don't think we have any definitive set of rules. But I would say there are some states we can write down, which I think we would all agree are clearly pathological. And I don't know if you're going to say. Luckily, I'm not sure that I can make that state.
Well, if I make you mean construct in
sure.
the laboratory, that's I agree you can't make it.
So,
but I don't see why it can't just exist.
Sorry to